Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting the new dramatic series In Treatment, Monday through Friday at 9:30 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Being a family caregiver, taking care of a loved one who is ill, elderly, or disabled, is hard. But it's harder than it needs to be, and there are things that we can do to change that, according to my guest, Suzanne Geffen-Mintz. She speaks both as a caregiver and as the co-founder and president of the National Family Caregivers Association, which provides information, support, and advocacy. Mintz is the author of the book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up. Her husband has had MS since 1974. He now needs help with the daily activities of living, dressing, bathing, toileting, eating, mobility, and transferring from bed to wheelchair. Mintz's book describes many of the emotions and day-to-day issues that affect caregiving families. Suzanne Mintz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get to a scary moment in your life that you bring up in your book. And like one of the scary moments is when your loved one is getting released from the hospital in a very compromised situation, maybe right after surgery or right after a stroke, and suddenly they're going to be in your care and you're not prepared for it and you don't know how to do it. So you tell the story in your book. This happened to you. Your husband, who has MS, on top of that, had bladder surgery. So he's getting released from the hospital with this big incision, and you live alone with him. You're 5 feet tall. What are some of the problems you had to deal with as soon as he was released back home?
Well, I think the problem started in the hospital where they wouldn't agree to give us a home care aide, because I knew that coming back home, Stephen was going to be in worse shape than he was when he went in. And I don't think we fully comprehended how much more difficult it would be. But it was very obvious as soon as we got home and we were trying to transfer him from the chair that we used for transportation to a manual chair in the house. And he, because of this incision across his stomach, he just was not able to use whatever strength he still had to help propel himself up. And so I went running around the neighborhood. We'd heard a lawnmower going in the yard behind us, and I just went running around the corner to see who I could find. And luckily, there was this tall, young, strapping guy. And I said, "I need your help. Come with me." And he, you know, was able to help. But it's silly to be put into a situation like that, which can certainly be extremely dangerous.
So what do you think should have been done? What kind of help should you have had when your husband was discharged?
Discharge planning is a misnomer, I would say. I would say it's not planning, it's just discharge. And there needs to be a more comprehensive way of helping families make that transition from hospital to home or hospital to nursing home. And we advise people to look into the discharge process as soon as they enter the hospital. I think part of the problem comes from the fact that people in hospitals, general hospitals, don't really understand disability. They don't seem to comprehend that if somebody's body does not work because of a spinal cord injury or whatever, that once you do a medical procedure, that they are going to be in worse shape than when they entered the hospital and therefore will need some extra assistance for a while going home. We reached out to a neighbor who was quite wonderful and came over during that first week every evening around 10:30 and every morning around, 6:30 to help me get Stephen in and out of bed because I just couldn't do it by myself.
You mentioned that family caregivers aren't trained. And let's talk about a great and terrifying example of that. Often nowadays, when your loved one is sent home from the hospital, they have to continue to be on IV, and you are expected to administer it. And so what happens is someone from the hospital, well, not someone from the hospital, someone who the hospital has called, comes to your home, gives you the home IV equipment and the bags of medicine, gives you a very brief demonstration of how to do it, and suddenly you're giving IV to your spouse or friend or parent or whatever, and it can just be terrifying because you've read in the instruction manual that if there's like an air bubble in the IV that you can kill the person, and you're thinking like, I don't know how to do this. I'm not a nurse. I'm not a doctor. Can you talk about this a little bit and why we're in this position?
The system, if you will, obviously is constantly trying to save money. Well, one way to do that is to have people come home sooner, and because of advances in science, they can come home sooner. But as I mentioned before, they're not healing any sooner. It's just that they're doing it on our watch. And I personally think it is unsafe and irresponsible to put that responsibility on us without giving us the support. We need a buddy. We need a navigator, a person who aids us through this entire process. There is so much money lost and so many errors because of the lack of really good care coordination. There are constant transitions along the way, and there is not one person other than us who has that connection.
What are some of the most challenging things you've had to learn how to do medically as a caregiver for your husband who has MS?
Probably the most challenging thing is how to catheterize him. Stephen has a urogenic bladder, which basically means that the muscles of his bladder will not open automatically. It's the opposite side of people who can't control their urine. And so we have to catheterize him 4 or 5 times a day. And we, of course, were petrified. We were hoping it might be something Stephen could do himself, but he really just does not have the hand dexterity. We had been looking through a copy of Paraplegic News, which is a magazine that I actually write for. And there was an advertisement about this whole new intermittent catheter system, which instead of having a separate catheter and a separate urinal, was a totally self-contained package. And we got a couple of samples. But again, there was nobody to ask. Finally, you know, we got it to work. It probably would have worked sooner if we weren't hadn't been so nervous or we had somebody looking over our shoulder.
This is horrifying, though. I mean, it's great you could do it at home. You don't need to go to the hospital for it. You'd have to go 4 times a day. I mean, this wouldn't work. But to have to do it by trial and error on your own is just horrifying.
But that's how most family caregivers learn. We learn on the job. Family caregivers are thrown into the healthcare system and asked to be a part of it, but are not given the respect, are not given the education and training. So we're thrown out there, and it certainly doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're not going to have somebody who you pick up off the street do brain surgery. But you pick us up off the street and have us do some elements of healthcare work without any support or education, without any understanding of what we bring to the situation in terms of both of our assets and our problems.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Suzanne Mintz. She's the co-founder and president of the National Family Caregivers Association and author of the book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up, It Doesn't Have to Be This Hard. In the best of all possible worlds, what kind of help do you think you should have with your husband's chronic condition?
I think that it is really important to have Stephen's doctors communicate with each other, to monitor medications, to understand how a symptom from, you know, his urinary tract has an impact on, you know, his mobility, or just putting all the pieces together so that there is one health professional. And it doesn't have to be the doctor. It could be somebody in the doctor's office, a PA or an RN who's doing the coordination. But somebody needs to have a complete record of Stephen's medical life. And there also needs to be an understanding of my abilities or lack of abilities to assist him. There needs to be a complete picture of our situation. But I don't think all the help that caregiving family needs is something that can be provided or should be provided by the healthcare system. I think we need to return to the image of barn building, where neighbors and family come together to help each other. We're all going to be in caregiving situations at some point in our lives, whether as the caregiver or as the care receiver. And so there are many things that communities can do to be supportive of each other.
Like what?
There are a number of mechanisms now that people are using. There's a great program called Lots of Helping Hands. It's a web-based program which is an expanded calendar, if you will, by which friends and family can sign up to do specific tasks that a caregiving family needs. One of the most important things is for the caregiving family to be able to say what it is they need. There is the typical situation, people say, call me if you need me. And, you know, the caregiver says, I will, and then never does and can't necessarily define a lot of the things they need help with. But some of the things we need help with are standard items. It's going to the grocery store. It's picking the kids up from soccer practice. It is mowing the lawn in the summer and shoveling the snow in the winter. And these are all part of our normal lives, but caregiving, of course, comes on top of those. So the things we need help with expand exponentially. And people can sign up for as much or as little help as they want to give, but in the process, they form a community of helpers.
There is the option of the home health care agencies, who will provide aids to your home at a fee. It's expensive. It's a pretty expensive way of doing it. But sometimes it's if you can afford it, it's an essential option. However, I think the home health care that you get through these agencies is erratic. You might get somebody who is caring and skilled and wonderful and attentive. And you might get somebody who's not skilled, not caring, and not attentive, and you're not going to know until after you've paid for them a while which category they fall into. If you've gotten somebody who isn't very good, it might take you three more tries to find somebody who is good. It's all very hit and miss, and in the meantime, you're just paying. So I'm wondering what your experiences have been with that kind of paid home health care and how you think we could maybe improve on that front.
Medicare does not pay for ongoing home care. They actually call it custodial care, which I think is extraordinarily pejorative. We are not custodians. And it raises the entire issue of our need for a better home health care workforce. People who are better trained, have a living wage and benefits, who have a career ladder that they can move up. But for the most part right now, that is not the circumstance. And so...
No, I should say they are really low paid when you take away what the agency is getting and you figure out what the home health care worker is actually making. They are really low paid.
Right. And, here they are giving health care and they're not often getting any health care benefits them themselves. And so you really have to love doing this work. And there are some people who are amazing. And as you said, there you can go through several times until you find somebody who's really working. And so there are the issues of expense. You know, most people can't necessarily afford ongoing care, even if it's just a couple of days a week for 4 hours, you know, 2 days a week or something.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the emotional needs of family caregivers. And you write about this a little in your book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up. Your husband was diagnosed with MS in 1974. And shortly after his diagnosis, as he started to become symptomatic, you were raped in your home while your husband was away from home. And you were both going through trauma. And you realized eventually that you both handled trauma and grief different from each other, and that this is an area in which you weren't particularly compatible. You weren't fulfilling each other's needs in this area. Would you describe those differences and the problems that they caused in the relationship?
You know, people talk about opposites attracting, and I suppose it is true. Stephen is the type of person who will tend to keep things in. I tend to like to share and, you know, get support in the talking out of it. So we approach things in a different way. But we were both going through grief for ourselves and for each other. And everybody does that differently. You may start out in denial, and I may start out in anger. And there are, you know, multiple feelings that one goes through in a grieving process. And I used to view Stephen as just being totally stubborn, not fighting, but more complacent. And what I realized is that he actually is a very strong and quiet fighter. His refusal to look into a new piece of equipment, or his still trying to climb stairs when it was so obvious how very, very difficult it was for him, that these were all not being stubborn, but rather his way of defying the MS. I learned to understand that once you admit that you really can't do something the way you were doing it anymore, it is a statement that you're going downhill, that you're not going to be going back in the other direction, that it is a nail in the coffin of your independence. And he came to understand how my nudging him to, well, why don't we, you know, get a stair glide, or let's get hand controls, or why don't we look at it this way, wasn't to be a nag, but because I was so concerned about his safety, and it was so painful for me to watch him struggling. And so we came up with a mechanism for dealing with things, and it has served us extremely well. Well, first of all, just the recognition that we both, you know, had rights in the relationship and that we looked at things differently was a light bulb going on. But what we have come up with is, since he's the one with the MS, that he's the initial driver, and we go with his direction, and I leave it alone. I try and be as supportive as I can, and not say anything. But when I reach a point where I am just so overwrought by it, where I really am concerned that he's going to hurt himself, I call time out. And at that point, we begin to look at things from my perspective. that it might be time for a new piece of equipment, or it might be time to get some help of one type or another. And then we work it out. We do it in a very understanding and supportive way that helps things be activities of mutual concern and love as opposed to a battle.
Suzanne Mintz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Suzanne Mintz is president of the National Family Caregivers Association and author of A Family Caregiver Speaks Up. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Cold War ended in the early 90s. Most of us would assume that also ended the decades of spy warfare between the Soviet spy agency, the KGB, and U.S. intelligence services. But veteran Soviet agent Sergei Tretyakov found that when the KGB morphed into the new Russian intelligence service, the SVR, it continued to target U.S. military and diplomatic secrets and worked to undermine U.S. foreign policy. Tretyakov had been the highest-ranking SVR operative working in the U.S., but during part of that time, he was working as a counter-spy for the U.S., stealing top-secret Russian diplomatic cables and classified Russian intelligence reports. In 2000, he defected to the U.S. and provided American authorities with a bounty of sensitive information about Russian intelligence activities in the U.S. and other countries. In return, he received the biggest resettlement package ever given by the U.S. Tretyakov's story is told in a new book by journalist Pete Early, who wrote two earlier books about American spies who gave secrets to the Soviets. His new book is called Comrade J, The Untold Secrets of Russia's Master Spy in America After the End of the Cold War. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to Sergei Tretyakov and Pete Early.
Well, Pete Early and Sergei Tretyakov, welcome both to Fresh Air. Sergei Tretyakov, let's hear your story. And it begins in the Soviet Union. Your grandmother worked for the Russian government. Your mother did briefly.
Yes.
Didn't want you to become a spy, but you wanted to become a KGB agent. Why?
Yes.
Why?
You know, probably because I was an idiot, you know. why I want to be a KGB agent? Because it, for me, it was fascinating. It's, you know, why people join intelligence services all over the world, you know. But anyway, it was my choice, and my parents told me, okay, it's your choice, what we can do.
When you joined the KGB, what was your impression of the quality of talent in the organization? Were these the best and brightest of Soviet society?
From the beginning, the impression was awful because for 5 years I worked in this research institute. And who worked there? The leftovers from the operational field people, you know. People who had problems with drinking and whatever, you know. That's why these people, they didn't impress me. But when I finally was accepted to the American Department of the first Chief Directorate Intelligence, I was impressed and I thought that I won't survive among these people for more than 6 months. Brightest people, great personality, you know, I was impressed.
You know, one of the interesting things, the early years that you spent in the KGB worked at this research institute, I guess a couple thousand employees were sifting through American newspapers and magazines, and this is
not
hard, no,
not only American,
okay,
European,
right, Western,
American.
Right,
yes, Western.
Mm-hmm. You did a piece of research that got you noticed when you were doing this research early in your KGB career. What was it?
I did many researches which were noticed. One of them was, I was looking in the archives, and I found on microfilms the document prepared for Congress. It's called American Overseas Installations Abroad. It was not a secret document, but when this document was translated, we understood that it was the best description of American overseas military installations for that time.
What Sergei did was he contacted the Congressional Library and got a copy of the congressional report that was prepared for senators about the status of military bases.
Yeah.
And then was able to extrapolate from that where the bases were, what kind of conditions they were in, and then even judging things like how long the runways were, what kind of military planes could land there, and based on things like how many movie theaters were in the area, how many people might be there. So it was a prime example of taking a public document that seems innocuous enough and information we share all the time in this country, and then extrapolating out military information that could be helpful to an enemy.
Well, Sergei Tretyakov, you finally got an overseas assignment for the KGB in 1990, where you went to Ottawa, Canada. And your job there was to sort of make friends among the Canadian government and Canadian nonprofit organizations and get information from them. And you were good at it. I mean, you got several people who gave you really good information that was helpful to the Soviet Union. But at the heart of it was deception. And, you know, most of us deceive people in our lives. I mean, in little ways. I mean, we make up excuses for not wanting to go to a social obligation or pretend we like people we don't, or some people cheat on their girlfriends or husbands. But it bothers us. I mean, I think most of us who deceive somebody, we're uncomfortable with it. And I'm wondering, how do you get comfortable with living a life of deception?
It's my profession. It's profession of any intelligence officer all over the world. And the job is to provide your government with valuable information, to recruit people, and just to extract information from them. It's nothing personal. It's not the deception or whatever, you know. It's how it works.
What he did was he became friends with people. He got them to relax. And an important thing to remember is in dealing with the Canadians, he didn't go after them saying, tell us something about Canada, because the truth was they didn't care about Canada. He said, oh, you know, the United States, they're big bullies. They're the last, you know, they're doing this, they're doing that. And he picked out people who had a strong anti-American streak, and he focused on them. And then he got them as his partner. So when it comes to deception, I think, Sergei, you were pretty open with – I mean, I think most people you dealt with knew you were Russian intelligence.
Absolutely.
Did they not? And you were trying to get them to not betray their own country but do this awful United States.
It was, of course, while you were in Canada – that the end of the Cold War occurred and the Soviet Union fell apart. And you tell a remarkable story of a visit in 1991 of some executives of new Russian companies who had plans to make money. One of them was a company called Chetek, which had this scheme to make money by treating toxic wastes. What was the idea?
This organization, Chetek, came to Canada. They were accompanying the guy who was the head of conversion program of the Soviet Union, Mr. Kulakov.
Nuclear conversion, you mean? Conversion of nuclear
weapons?
No,
conversion. No, he was the head of the conversion. It means conversion of military industrial complex to civilian, you know, sector.
Okay.
And they came, three of them, and I had assignment from Moscow to assist them. But when I heard what they had, I was shocked, because Dmitriev, the president of this privately owned company, he claimed that he has his own nuclear bomb, atomic bomb. And his idea was to drill a deep hole somewhere up north in Arctic and for big money collect the nuclear waste, chemical waste from all over the world, to put it into this deep hole, and then to blow up the bomb. And in his opinion, the chemical and other waste could disappear.
But just to be clear, the plan was to drill holes in the Arctic.
Yes.
Accept chemical and nuclear waste from other countries for a feed.
Yes.
Dump it down the hole and then detonate it with a nuclear weapon.
When Sergei first told me this story, I thought, this is fantastic. I mean, this has to be an exaggeration. But I found all the documents that support it. And it was not just one hole. They were going to drill like 30-some holes. They had the actual meters figured out, how much waste could be put in. And not only did they want to destroy all this waste, and they had how much they were going to charge for it, but this company actually was going to destroy other nuclear devices too. And it was taken so seriously. It was presented to the UN at one point, and Sergei alerted various Canadian officials about this plan and got press about it that helped the company eventually had to disband and was embarrassed. And it was the International Herald Tribune and other newspapers covered it. And he also notified Yeltsin that this guy had an atomic bomb supposedly in his dacha that he'd gotten in payment from scientists to propose this idea.
So just to be clear, we're not talking about nuclear weapons that were available for this waste-burning exercise, but the guy, as payment from scientists, as a down payment, he had his own personal nuclear bomb in his country house.
Yes, country house, on his garage, you know. But it was amazing. And these people from Chetek, how to put it in the political correct way, they were not very smart. And I encouraged them. You know, it's so great that you have this atomic bomb. And there was a press conference, like 26 journalists were present. And they told, tell everyone about this. It's great. And they voiced it. I was interpreting for them. And the reaction was, you can imagine.
Well, Sergei Tretyakov, there was a point when in 1994, uh-huh. after, you know, the change had occurred and the Soviet Union no longer existed, where you went back from your assignment in Canada to what had been the KGB's central headquarters to work. It was now, I guess, the SVR, the Russian intelligence.
Yes.
What were your observations about the place then? How had it changed?
It was really stressful. Before I went to Canada, it was polished organization with interesting professional people working with you.
You said a polished organization.
Polished, yes. Polished because people were well-dressed, with knowledge of several foreign languages, good professionals. When I returned back from Canada, I couldn't recognize it. In many departments of the SVR, it's the headquarters in Yasnivo, in some departments at 11 o'clock, everyone was drunk, believe it or not. And in men's restroom, there were dozens and dozens of empty bottles of vodka every day. It was a disaster, and it was so stressful. And the second thing is that the best officers, the most talented, they left the service and they joined business community and became well-off people.
Why do you think it deteriorated so badly? I mean, presumably effective intelligence is important to any government. Why? I mean, the picture you paint of the headquarters then is really dramatic, as you said.
It's dramatic.
Vodka bottles all around. Why did it deteriorate so?
It was a shock for the whole KGB. KGB ceased to exist. And everyone, like me, who worked in the organization, we thought that we are indestructible. And then all of a sudden, the organization ceased to exist. And people lost interest. Before that, we were all motivated. We didn't work for money. It was like a patriotic call, patriotic duty. But then the new government, like people like Yeltsin, when you work in the intelligence, you know exactly who is running the country and what kind of people are running the country. And when you see all these drunks, you know, thieves, you name it, the organization changed. We lost the reason to work for the government because you don't respect the government.
Let's not forget, too, that the KGB was hated by many of the people in the Soviet Union who were its victims, and that the KGB had a certain amount of privileges. They were elite. And when Yeltsin and the new Democrats came in, a lot of that shifted. And so it was not quite as glamorous to be in the KGB or in being, Sergei was in foreign intelligence. So he wasn't involved in the departments that were arresting and murdering people. But that was also a part of the KGB's legacy.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Sergei Tretyakov, you were in New York for the Russian intelligence from 1995 to 2000 there with wife, Helen, and your daughter.
Yes.
And one of the things that's interesting that you write is that one of the objectives, apart from gathering information, was to do all you could to disseminate information which would undermine U.S. foreign policy. And you write, you're quoted as saying in Peter Early's book, our goal was to cause dissension and unrest inside the U.S. and anti-American feelings abroad. Now, why was this a goal now that the Cold War was over and the U.S. and Russia were no longer ideological adversaries, theoretically allies?
Cold War was never over. There was period of weakness in Russia. When Russia economy deteriorated, it was a total chaos in Russia. Then situation started to improve, not really in the Russian economy, but because of natural gas and oil. Russian government has a lot of money. And because they have a lot of money, they are back in business. It's competition. And nothing changed. If you look at what Russia is doing right now, in any part of the world, like Iranian nuclear program, Iranians couldn't even think about having their own nuclear program without Russian assistance. Go to Middle East. Hamas and Hezbollah, which are recognized in most countries as terrorists, Russians support them as national liberation movement. If you go to Latin America, Hugo Chavez is the best friend of Russians, and he is buying more weapons than anyone else in the world. And Russians, they are arming one of our who doesn't like us.
Sergei Tretyakov, while you were in New York, you managed to get a Russian intelligence operative, Alexander Kramar, in the UN's Food for Oil program. And just to remind listeners, this was the program in which Iraq, which was then under UN trade sanctions, was permitted to sell oil in return specifically for food and other humanitarian goods. And the way it worked was the UN would supervise these Iraqi oil vouchers, which would be matched with a foreign buyer who would then put money into a UN account. And theoretically, the oil could be sold and the goods sent for the benefit of the people of Iraq rather than Saddam Hussein and his own uses. And a Russian intelligence operative was actually, with your assistance, put into a position here to monitor this program. Now, and I'm wondering, what was the result of your Russian intelligence operative getting involved in this UN Oil for Food program?
First of all, when Oil for Food program started, there were four international independent controllers. One Russian, one American, one Belgian, and one Norwegian.
France,
yes. And with time, three left, found better jobs. And Kramer was left alone to approve these contracts.
That's the Russian intelligence operative, Alexander Kramer.
Yes, he was illegally introduced to this position, but in reality, he was colonel like me. In the Russian intelligence, of course, no one knew about it because they wanted someone really neutral, professional expert working for this program. Alexander Kramer was a lousy operative, below zero. And I always wanted to get rid of him, to send him back to Russia. But all of a sudden, he was awarded by the presidential administration and approved by the Gosduma, the Russian parliament, with one of the highest medals, awards in Russia. And it was outrageous because none of my officers got reward like this, and they were good officers.
Well, what had Kramer done to earn this accolade?
This is Pete Early's research. And I think it's excellent because I knew what he was doing. He was stealing money for the Russian government. But Pete Early describes the methods, how it was done.
When Kramer was put in charge, and he was answering to Sergei, and Sergei was reading his memos, and he knew money was being stolen. But what he was doing was, when he was the only one in charge, he priced the difference between the vouchers and by 35 cents. Now, what did this mean? This means that if I got a voucher to sell 10 million units of oil, and it was priced 35 cents under the market, I pocketed that profit when I turned around and sold it. And he enabled the Russian government to steal $500 million. $500 million went into Russia. Some of it went to the Russian Presidential Council. We were able to track some of it to the office of the president, but you can't find, for instance, Putin's fingerprints on all this. But Putin then, in turn, gave this guy this high honor. But he personally set the price so that Russians could steal $500 million in profits.
And we should note that there was, you know, there were revelations of corruption among other officials in the Oil for Food program. But you have here this Russian official stealing a lot for himself, for friends of the Russian government, and for the Russians. And Sergei Tretyakov, what effect did this have on your opinion of the government that you were working for?
Actually, it just was another proof that it became immoral to work for this government. Because Russian people, right now in Russia, they have a very strong propaganda campaign about how good the economy is, etc. It's not true. The life is a kind of bearable in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But the normal Russians, including people, retired people, veterans, they're suffering. No one takes care of them. If you travel like 50 miles from Moscow, it's 17th century. They don't have running water in many places, you know. And a lot of people working for the government became extremely rich. For example, you know that Putin was nominated the Man of the Year by
Time Magazine, right?
Yeah. Time Magazine. And they claim, and I think they are serious people, that his personal wealth is just several billion dollars. And I'm asking the question. He was never with the business community. He was always a state serviceman. How he managed to make this kind of money?
Sergei Tretyakov, tell us about your decision to defect. What convinced you to do it?
Not only me, my wife, myself, we developed a very strong, if you want, I'll put it this way, allergic reaction. I couldn't serve that government anymore. And it was a dramatic decision because you understand that if something went wrong, nothing good would happen to our family.
What can either of you tell me about Sergei's life today? He's living under an assumed name somewhere in the United States?
No, he doesn't live in an assumed name. He became an American citizen, and he believes that affords him a certain amount of protection and rights. He does not disclose from what state he lives, but he lives a very ordinary life. He has a very nice house. He doesn't have to work. Sergei, jump in.
Actually, all three of us, we became American citizens. We don't have relatives in Russia, which is good, because I would never leave hostages. The last living relative was my mom, who died.
You don't fear for your safety, Sergei?
Of course, we take safety issues seriously. But, you know, all three of us, we became American citizens. And I think that Putin and others, they must send some special people to the United States to protect me. Because if something happens to me, like a drunk driver will run over me, you know, it will be very difficult to explain that the Russian officials didn't participate in it.
Well, there's certainly been other officials who have died under very mysterious circumstances.
Yes, I don't want to speak to you because I don't know, like Litvinenko case, Politkovskaya and others. I can't tell you because I have no I don't have any information. But again, mentioning my discussions with Mr. Zoltov, with Mr. Murov, the security guy and the physical protection of the president, these people think in different categories, you know.
Well, Peter Early and Sergei Tretyakov, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Sergei Tretyakov and Pete Early spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Early's new book about Tretyakov is called Comrade J.